Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Gates, how Erdic research affects you. We're on episode 17 this morning, and I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Edith Martinez Guerra, and she is going to be talking about what is water resilience and why is it important, which is such a very hot topic these days. And she is a research environmental engineer with the Environmental Lab, otherwise known as EL. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing great.
Great. So glad to have you here. And we're going to talk about a lot of great things. But first of all, what is your role at Erdic?
Well, as you mentioned, I'm a research environmental engineer. I've been there for the last almost 6.5 years, mm-hmm. right after school, right after I finished my PhD. I joined to the environmental engineering branch.
Okay.
And I've been working on water research since then, or anything related to the environment, but mainly water topics.
Okay. So tell me about yourself and your background, and what steps did you take to get where you are, and what is your relationship with the community?
Ooh, that's a long story.
It's a long question, isn't it?
It's a long story.
You know what? Everybody sit back.
I was born and raised in a small village in El Salvador, and I came to the United States to join my parents when I was 15. I went to high school here in Arkansas, and then I put myself through college. I did my bachelor's in Arkansas and then came to Mississippi for my master's and stayed for my PhD in civil and environmental engineering. And right after, that's when I joined Erdic.
Okay. Well, that's great. That's great.
I keep it short.
Well, you know, I love stories, and that's a great story. So tell me, how did you get interested, or why did you get interested in the subject of water?
Like I mentioned, I grew up in a small village in El Salvador, and I had to carry my own water.
So carried your own water?
Yeah, like, we didn't have running water.
Okay.
We had to go to a river or the nearest well to buy water. Mm-hmm. And we also didn't have power. I think I was around 13 when we got power. So I was always interested in water. I knew there got to be a better way to do this than carrying the water. I've always I had an interest in on it, and when I was in second grade, my teacher told me I was going to be a civil engineer, but I was like,
in second grade,
I was like, I don't want to do something related with water. Mm-hmm. And when I was about 6 or 7, I got hepatitis A from drinking contaminated water, and that can damage your liver. And mm-hmm. I was always thinking on like helping people, you know, to clean their water somehow. And when I was an undergraduate student in civil engineering, because my teacher told me,
so. You did what your teacher told you.
I took a class called Intro to Environmental Engineering, mm-hmm. and I wrote a paper, which I'm teaching that class in the same university this
How
semester.
How fun is that? That's great.
So I wrote a paper on water, the type of things that people flush.
Right.
And the toilet, you know, like contraceptives and pills that people, and how this was contaminating the water. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay, that's how it's called, what I want to study, environmental engineering. Mm-hmm. So that it's related to water. It talks about cleaning water. So when I went to grad school, I told my professor, I want to get a master's in water treatment, water and wastewater treatment. Mm-hmm. And although I did a lot of work in biofuel, my thesis and my dissertations are in bioenergy or biofuel. Mm-hmm. I still work with my professor in other projects related to water desalination, wastewater treatment, and all my classes were mostly in water and wastewater treatment.
Fantastic. So how long are you going to be teaching this class?
The whole semester?
The whole semester.
Yes, okay. I'm giving a test next week. I finished at 8 a.m.
Okay, great.
It's 1 hour, twice a week.
Well, that's fun to hear the connection that you have with your passion for this, the water resiliency.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I love water.
What is water resilience and why is it so important?
Well, resilience, it means to bounce back. How fast can you bounce back when you fail, and how do you prepare yourself for future failures? How do you bounce back faster then? So similarly to anything in life, water resilience is about how fast can you recover from a failure? How fast can you reconnect your services when for some reason it goes down? So water resiliency is that ability to provide water services without any interruptions. Ideally, right?
We wouldn't.
Of course, you would have outages, either from infrastructure failures, from plant outages for maintenance. Mm-hmm. But you want to have, you want to prepare for that. You want to plan ahead, and there should be enough redundancy to avoid these outages to prolonged. So the key to resiliency then is the redundancy, mm-hmm. Having backups in there, such as backup pumps, backup power. Well, power resilience is the whole topic itself.
Oh, really? Okay.
yes. And that's, we're going to talk later on when we talk about IWP.
Okay.
Because it includes the energy and water part.
Oh, great. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So having, those backups in place, that's what makes a system or a plant, in this case, resilient. Backups, backup pumps, spare parts, valves, and so on. So what is more important, right, than water for a living, for all of us?
We gotta have it.
We gotta have water. And that's why it is important, because of our end users, our community. We think of a hospital, for example. How long can a hospital go without water? Mm-hmm. Or we don't know individual needs in our community that they might be going through, and water is vital, although we already know it's vital for life, but it might be immediately vital to someone.
Right.
That's why resilience is very important.
Okay. So what are some main causes of failure when it comes to water treatment plants, and how do we assess their resilience?
I think like in any system, the main cause of failure is the lack of maintenance. But continuous maintenance requires finances, right? It requires some investment. And the best way to assess the resilience is to generate a baseline of current conditions, to develop a resilience plan, and of course, execute it. Mm-hmm. But like I mentioned, that will require finances, require fundings, investment.
Okay. So what is the Installation Energy and Water Plan project, otherwise known as IEWP?
Yeah, the IEWP, or the IWIP, is a project that we've worked on the last few years. I joined the team in 2019. At first, my team lead was a little bit hesitant of me joining it, because the IEWP is more consulting than research. You know? But there are the Army installations that we are really familiar with. Mm-hmm. But I started working on the Installation Status Report Mission Capacity Tool, which is the one I use for Jackson. I just adapted it to a water treatment plant. Mm-hmm. And after I joined it and completed that tool, I learned what was being done on the water side. And it's my area of study, water in college, right after my civil engineering degree. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed the IWIP. And I start visiting the installations. Right now, I could even write one by myself.
Oh, wow. Okay, great.
Do the whole assessment.
Okay, great. So what are some assessments that have been conducted recently?
Our IWIP team have conducted several assessments. We have worked on more than 30 Army installations, and we're working on some of them currently. Not only CONUS, but OCONUS also. Mm-hmm. I don't think I am allowed to tell you the site that we've worked on.
Okay.
But we have worked on several, and it's still an ongoing thing, because it was an executive order that came out a few years ago, where they said that each Army installation must be resilient for at least 14 days.
Okay.
So they should go uninterruptedly water and energy. So they should have everything, all the redundancy in place to meet, to support the critical facilities. And they define, or the installation, the stakeholders, that they decide what a critical facility, mm-hmm. what is critical to them. So they should be able to serve those facilities for 14 days, no interruptions.
Wow, that would be great.
Yeah,
that would be great.
Making it resilient.
So how many team members and partners are part of resiliency assessments and review of infrastructure issues?
In the IWIP?
And in your projects that you conduct?
Oh, well, for the energy, because we do them at the same time, mm-hmm. and the project manager is for both energy and water. So it's about four, five, even six people on the on the energy side. Mm-hmm. And for water, we can go 2 to 4. Like I've told you, I've been in some instances that I've done it all by myself.
Right, right. So are they all engineers that work with these projects?
Yeah, most of them. Some of them are because we have a variety of backgrounds at mm-hmm. Arctic. Mm-hmm. So we have, some of them might be scientists. We have had a biologist, I think, working with us. And there's other people from the districts that also support us.
So the different partners that come together to work together. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yes, USAID district, of course.
Right, right. So when assessments are made, what are the main factors to look for?
We look for redundancy, right? Like I mentioned, that's the key for mm-hmm. resilience. So the number of water sources, if they should have, you know, for redundancy in case something happened to one of your sources, you should have more than one source, backup pumps, current infrastructure conditions. And this includes condition of the pumps, manholes, lift stations in case of wastewater, and conditions of the distribution system, how is your piping, it's your infrastructure, edging. So we look into that and we come up with COAs, we call it, courses of action or proposed projects that they should execute within 5 years, because the IWP is supposed to be 5 years and it's a living document that they have to update every year. For example, if we suggest, okay, you need to replace this many lines of pipe from this FY from whatever quarter we start, and they do it, and then they would show on the next year that they have actually updated. Mm-hmm. We don't look at the document right until the 5 years have passed, but internally the stakeholders along with the commanders, they go over those over the IWP and they do their check mark and keep adding appendices as they move on with the project. So other things that we look into is if the site has water or wastewater treatment in place. Mm-hmm. Ideally, you would like to have your own wastewater, be self-sufficient.
Right.
Have your own water treatment, and in case of a failure. Mm-hmm. From the provider, or any outages that might affect your critical facilities. So if they have a water treatment plant in place, we assess that. Mm-hmm. We check into the current conditions. How are they operating it? Do they have a qualified personnel to operate it? And we do the same thing with wastewater treatment to avoid, or at least they should have enough storage. Mm-hmm. By enough storage capacity for water, and also to keep their sewage in case something goes wrong down the pipe from the provider. And something that is not really part of the IWP questionnaire, but we do assess, is the stormwater.
Really?
Yes, because that's the main thing, right? What if it floods?
Right.
The rainfall, heavy rain floods. So we look into if the site have storm water infrastructure in place, what mm-hmm. type of infrastructure, are they having any issues that we can help with, any projects that we might come up with and help them find fundings for it, mm-hmm. and also best management practices for the runoff. Mm-hmm. And something else that a lot of the installations are talking about nowadays, because like you mentioned, this is a hot topic.
Very hot, yes.
It's rainwater harvesting. And there are some sites that they are already doing that. They collect their runoff maybe, or they collect it from the roof.
Right.
It's usually easier to collect it from the roof because they don't have to do much treatment than if they collect the rain from the ground, right? Mm-hmm. The runoff, and they collect it in ponds, and they would have to do more treatment to remove all those sediments or any contaminant that the water might have picked up on its way. So we look into those kind of things so they can have another water source for redundancy and to be resilient.
Okay. I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
Stuffing more people in your house this holiday? You'll be thankful for the fastest internet. Get CableLink's broadband up to 150 meg internet and unlimited data together for under $25 per month. All your wireless devices connect best with CableLink's broadband, especially when you have friends and family come over with all their devices. Plus, we make it easy to switch. There's no credit check, no money up front, and no deposit. This holiday, gather family and friends for pie and Wi-Fi. download Family Games at cablelinks.com/thankful. That's cablelinks.com/thankful. And get Cablelinks broadband up to 150 meg internet and unlimited data under $25 per month. Order Cablelinks today at 800-903-0508. That's 800-903-0508. Or email support at cablelinks.com. Or click to chat through cablelinks.com. Offers expire without notice and many factors affect speed. Other restrictions may apply.
We have to stop by the bank.
Dad, is this a new bank?
Well, it's different on the outside, but inside, it's all the same great stuff. And a little bit more.
Like when Aunt Tess comes back from the salon?
No, son, this will last longer than that.
Bancorp South and Cadence Bank have come together to form a new, even better bank to help the people, companies, and communities we serve prosper. The new Cadence Bank, helping opportunity take shape. Learn more at cadencebank.com/thenewcadence. Member FDIC.
There's plenty of fish in the sea, and we should know. At Palmer's, it's our specialty. We have easy peel shrimp, royal reds, and crab legs by the pound. Not feeling shellfish? Then try our seafood platter with catfish, shrimp, and oysters battered in our own secret recipe. Palmer's, located in the Outlet Mall, is carryout only for now, but we'll be opening the dining room soon. So when you feel like some surf instead of turf, call Palmer's at 601-738-8484. Open Wednesday and Thursday, 11 to 8, and Friday and Saturday, 11 to 9.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
So if you're just tuning in, I am speaking with Dr. Edith Martinez-Guerra, and she is with the Environmental Lab at ERDC, and she's a research environmental engineer. And we are talking about what is water resilience and why is it important. So all communities need safe drinking water and properly treated wastewater. In order to provide these services reliably, what do you suggest be done?
Like anything, right? We need to start planning, always be ahead.
Right.
Start planning and upgrading with anticipation. Don't wait until your system failed, right? So that you can maintain it and upgrade it. Wait until you have no options. So you have to keep your spare parts. Like I mentioned, mm-hmm. the redundancy, you have to, I don't know, probably alternate them. Mm-hmm. So you keep both of them or however many you have in place. And just be anticipating for it and hire well-trained personnel, because that can be a key role also in the failure of your plant. Mm-hmm. If you don't have the right people in place, right? You always want the right people for the job.
Right, right.
So you need a well-qualified personnel, certified operators, because you don't necessarily, if you go to work at a plant, you should be at a trained or certified operator to actually operate that plant.
Right.
And to also have a qualified plant manager that can run the system and that makes sure, you know, that everything, if any failure, the operators are reporting every day or anything going on. Because if the operator reports, write down whatever happened during the day, but who is going over that? Mm-hmm. So having a well-qualified plant manager is also a way for the communities to prepare and maintain this service with the community. So something else that is very important is having operation and maintenance in place. Mm-hmm. And maintenance should be done regularly. They should have scheduled maintenance of their systems, of all their systems. That's why they should have those backup where they can, you know, work on one, have the other one.
Right.
Not discard one just because.
Right, right.
And something else would be a standard of procedure that is important for each system. You never know, right, when you're going to, one of your workers is going to move to a different position, find another job, or someone is going to retire. So if you have this standard of procedure on how everything is operated, and even for the new employees, mm-hmm. and so have that continuity of operation is also important in the plant. So in case of the providers, I think they should start planning depending on the service geography. Mm-hmm. If you are in an area that is prone to hurricanes,
right,
you should start preparing for that way ahead of time. Same thing, you know, with flooding areas, or like in the West Coast, for example, they're having a lot of drought issues. Mm-hmm. They should be preparing for that in advance. Mm-hmm. And many, many other climate or environmental threats that we might not count on that they might happen.
If you think it can happen, prepare for it.
Yes.
Pretty much.
Always ahead of time. The American Society of Civil Engineers, mm-hmm. which I've been a member of since I was an undergraduate student.
Great. Okay.
So ASCE, that's how it's known. So every 4 years that they do the rating of the infrastructure for the country. Mm-hmm. And we've known that the national infrastructure is aging, and the grade, I don't remember what it is now, but it has been D for a long time. Mm-hmm. So also start working on that, right? Taking care of the aging pipe networks from water distribution systems. So I think that the key is to start preparing as soon as yesterday.
Right.
We're well behind. You know, whatever happened in Jackson, it might be something that's just the beginning.
Right. Okay. So what is the best way to plan for and practice responding to water emergencies?
Well, as previously mentioned, the best way is to prepare ahead, right? You don't want to be in the position to be responding to water emergency. Well, ideally, right? And there should be enough redundancy that you don't have to rush or plan on the go. Mm-hmm. However, if you are already there, you're already responding to the emergency, is that the best way to respond is by sending the right people mm-hmm. and the required tools. And of course, right, we need money.
Right. That money keeps coming up.
Yes. Yeah, it's a funding investment right. in your infrastructure and your community. Because, yeah, you can have the right people, but you need to buy tools. You need to probably replace pumps that they are not really that inexpensive.
Right, right. But it gets to be expensive when you need it at the last minute, though, right?
Yes, when you're planning on the go.
So how do you monitor systems for contaminants?
Most places have water meters in place, mm-hmm. so sensors. And they do their water quality testing often, for example, in the water plants in Mississippi. The Department of Health does the continuous testing on not every day, mm-hmm. every certain time throughout the day. So they have many data points, although they have meters in place that they can read. Not that you always need to verify because
right.
the errors, human errors, even the equipment might be a little bit off. Mm-hmm. So they're still monitoring for those contaminants in the lab.
Okay. So what are some examples of critical vulnerabilities in water plant operations and some examples of recommendations to improve the operations and resiliency?
There are several critical vulnerabilities, including security procedures, internal systems control, but cybersecurity and control systems. They're a little bit out of my area of expertise. Okay. But from my side, as an engineer, I would say that the lack of backup and redundancy for critical parts of the water system, mm-hmm. that can be one of your major failures. And other vulnerabilities that sometimes might seem out of our hand, like I mentioned, are the natural disasters. Mm-hmm. But if we can anticipate and build robust, well-engineered systems, we might not be able to fully eliminate environmental threats, but we could probably reduce the impact that it might have in our system. And then again, anticipation, redundancy, and that's the way to go.
Right, right. So, as we wrap up, so what do you want listeners to remember from this valuable conversation?
I would like them to be more conscious of their consumption. Mm-hmm. And I want to tell people, how long should you take in the shower?
But people need to be more conscious of that,
yeah.
Do they not?
Yeah, to me, it's like, why do you stay in the shower 30 minutes when you can accomplish the same thing in 10 minutes?
Right.
So be conscious of their consumption, of the more water you need. Well, in the South, we're blessed, right, by the amount of water that we have. We have the river right there,
right.
A few miles from where we're at right now. And that other places might not have that not option, but that water, if you waste it, you still have to be sent to a water treatment plant or a wastewater treatment plant, right?
So
that's
right.
Extra necessary load probably to your treatment system. So I would like the people to be more conscious of their consumption. They're now faucets are more environmental friendly, toilets. Mm-hmm. I know that some people, and even myself, I would be I don't want to invest, right? Because it might be expensive. But if in the long run, mm-hmm. you might be saving way more than
in your water consumption.
Because mm-hmm. water, that we don't really pay much attention to our water bills, right? We see, it went like $1 up.
Right, right.
$3 from last year. And we don't pay much attention to that. But it's actually going up. And eventually it's going to get even much, much higher. Another thing I would like people to think about, and I'm teaching a class this semester, and I remind my students every day, do not flush random things down your toilet. It's like, if it's not necessary, not coming out of, you don't need to be flushing things because that can take a toll on your infrastructure, right? You might clog your pipes, your pumps. You might ruin your valves. You might break something in your
you're making people think, oh, she's got a point. That's good.
Yeah, because I've heard that whenever people are looking into looking into manholes and at things that have been flushed,
right.
Like how? Or
how did they do that?
Yeah, why? How did it even go through? And well, be thankful that it went through, right? That it didn't log. But if you keep adding stuff, and they're just going to be building in there if they're not.
Doesn't just affect you, it affects the whole system.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, see? Something to think about, people.
Trash, same thing, right? When we throw just trash out of the window, that I've seen people throwing trash out of the window. And then people complaining about floodings, for example. Mm-hmm. But all that trash have to end up somewhere, right? So the current is going to take it to your gutters, to your manhole, and it might block them, and it might end up flooding the area. So this more being conscious about the environment.
Okay. Well, do you have anything you'd like to add to our conversation?
No. What else would you like to know?
Well, I do want to say thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you.
And we appreciate you and love to have you back again sometime.
Whenever you invite me.
Awesome.
Maybe a different topic.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, thank you for listening to Beyond the Gates, How Arctic Research Affects You. And we'll come back at you next week. Have a great day.
Now News Talk 1490 and 107.7 FM presents the legendary Paul Harvey and the rest of the story. And now,
the rest of the story. Imagine taking a deep breath and nothing happens. No, I mean nothing, as though you had never inhaled at all. That happened to Chris one night just after dinner. He took a breath and yet he did not. Predictably, he panicked. He tried to breathe again and again, but his oxygen-starved bloodstream could not be force-fed. Then came the cramping, then the diaphragmatic spasms. An ambulance arrived in time, and Chris was rushed to Good Samaritan Hospital, Los Angeles. There was emergency treatment followed by tests, and the test results were astonishing. Chris's lungs were coated with a fine dust. Aluminum dust? Aluminum dust. Now this is the rest of the story. Once upon a time, Chris had been a pre-med student, and show business was the furthest thing from his mind. But when his family went broke in Florida's land boom, Chris dropped out of school and went to New York in search of work. His dancing instructor father had encouraged him to take dance lessons years previous. Broadway needed good dancers. So Chris got a job in the chorus of a musical. There followed more musicals and better parts. And before he knew it, Chris was performing musical comedy in Hollywood. And he was a star under contract to MGM. He also appeared in loan outs to 20th Century Fox. But then, one autumn, Chris was offered the role of a lifetime. It was a part in a surefire hit picture that would make his a household name forever after. It was a most unusual role, requiring an exotic costume and makeup, but within 4 weeks of rehearsals, there was plenty of time to experiment to get everything just right. The makeup artists finally settled on clown white grease paint, followed by generous powder puffing of pure aluminum dust. In one 10-hour shooting, Chris would be powdered 24 or more times, and each of those times he would be breathing the metallic dust, taking more and more of it into his lungs. It was very early in the production that Chris was rushed to the hospital. His skin was a brilliant blue. He struggled for each breath. And yet beneath his oxygen tent, he continued to receive telephone calls from the studio. The moguls, characteristically short on sympathy, now were furious. Chris could not possibly be sick, they insisted. He was due on the set. But Chris was sick. A severe reaction to his metal dust makeup. And although after many weeks he did recover, chronic bronchitis plagues him to this day. The once-in-a-lifetime movie role that went to another actor, on whom the makeup artists used aluminum paste instead of dust. After losing the part, Chris's show business career went into a tailspin. More than two decades would pass before he reemerged as a television superstar of the first magnitude. And so it is Jack Haley, whom generations of children have loved and remembered as the Tin Woodman in The Wizard of Oz. But because Chris was allergic to tin, he had to drop out of Dreamland, only to strike it rich in 1962 as Jed Clampett of the Beverly Hillbillies, and again as a charming and tenacious detective called Barnaby Jones. Ah, yes, you've long admired Chris. That's his Christian name, Christian, but you've always called him Buddy. Buddy Ebsen, and now you know the rest of the story.
You've been listening to Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story on News Talk 1490 and 107.7 FM.